Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How will Texas change as a result of the 84th session of the state legislature? This term's lawmakers will be sworn in next Tuesday, and those returning to the state Senate in particular will find most of the new faces belong to politicians whose views are further to the right than those who preceded them. They are likely to consider measures related to perpetual issues like transportation, education, and energy, along with a proposal to allow for open carry of firearms, and perhaps, if Lieutenant Governor-elect Dan Patrick has his way, measures to further enhance state efforts to secure our border with Mexico. Journalist Erica Greeter writes for Texas Monthly Magazine, where last month she published a profile of Lieutenant Governor-elect Dan Patrick and an exit interview with outgoing LG David Dewhurst. She joins us now to talk about what's ahead in the next 140 days of intensive budgeting and lawmaking. Erica, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
You have a fairly sanguine outlook on the immediate future of state politics. How much does it help that lawmakers this year are not dealing with the kind of dire budget straits that made, say, 2011 so brutal?
Well, I think that helps enormously. That's probably the main reason I'm so sanguine right now. I think there are two things that can really derail a session. A budget shortfall would be the big one. The other one would be politics. And I think because we've seen revenues coming in pretty well thus far, despite the drop in oil prices, which we can talk about later if you'd like, we'll have a budget outlook that looks pretty good probably when the ledge resumes. And that makes it easier for them to fund the state's priorities, possibly even expand spending in certain areas like road funding without having to make any sort of painful cuts that would trigger painful fights.
So it's just easier to do politics when there's more resource to go around.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, obviously in 2011, as you mentioned, in that case, they were looking at a shortfall that was projected to be up to $27 billion, you know, on a fairly lean state budget. So that colored the entire session. They had to spend, you know, those 4 months basically arguing out what to cut, what to put on the chopping block first, what to cut most. In 2013, with coming back in with the surplus, with the sort of expanded breathing room for spending, they were able to skip those fights and just think about, do we want to, you know, build some more medical schools, expand mental health funding, and so on.
Okay, oil prices, as you mentioned, are lower now than many of us imagined they would ever be again, which is great if you're heating your house or filling your gas tank. Yeah. What does it mean, though, for the energy industry in Texas?
Well, so it's interesting because for the energy industry, it's not good. You know, obviously, if you're an oil company, you're not thrilled about this development. But for the state of Texas, I think it means less than people think it would mean. I think I don't know about you, Chris, but I was born in the 80s, so I don't remember how the 80s felt in Texas. But I get the sense that a lot of people do remember how the 80s felt in Texas. Mm-hmm. And they have these sort of flashbacks to how bad that was and how horrible it was in the state.
Empty office buildings everywhere, people out of work, that sort of thing.
Right. I mean, it sounds like they're describing something sort of post-apocalyptic. But I think at that point, you know, the state, it was a very sobering moment for the state. It was a very different state at that point. It was about 11, 12 million people. Now we're 27 million. It was a much less diversified economy. And we've changed so much in the past 40 years, partly because I think people realized you can't build an entire state economy on the energy industry, which is notoriously volatile. So coming into this session, I mean, an oil price drop will translate to lower oil tax revenues, but those are, you know, a small share of the state's overall GR revenue collections. It could mean, it probably will mean, of course, layoffs in the industry, and that could affect, you know, consumer spending statewide. But in the meantime, thus far, at least, the state's actually coming out ahead on the revenue side, because as you said at the beginning, if you're a consumer in Texas right now, you're spending more money because energy's cheaper. So sales taxes are actually coming in higher than that. They're offsetting the oil tax drop thus far.
What share of revenue do oil and gas typically contribute to the state budget?
So it's about 6% of overall tax collections, and that translates to about 3% of overall revenues, because about half of our general revenue collections are taxes and half are fees. So it's, you know, it's a significant stream in a state that's so lean as far as taxing and spending. Any percent matters, right? But it's not 20%, which is what it was in the 80s. And that's partly because, you know, as a result of the 80s bust, the state then moved to establish the Rainy Day Fund, which we hear discussed a lot because it's sort of the you know, infrastructure set-aside fund. The majority of oil tax revenues flow into that fund because I think there was a, you can see the mentality reflected in that, that the state decided in the 80s we weren't going to plan on oil tax revenues being a predictable part of the baseline budget because they really can't be that well.
So it actually makes sense that the Rainy Day Fund is sitting there. It's in pretty good shape as of this year. Do you imagine that the lockdown on that money will remain as it's been?
Well, there's certainly been a very strong political impetus to keep that money in there. It's about $8 billion right now. And in December, the Legislative Budget Board, I think it was a Joint Select Committee, decided to keep about $7 million in it. It is sort of meant for a rainy day. And so like last session, you had these debates about what constitutes a rainy day, when should we withdraw from the Rainy Day Fund. If we actually have a rainy day in the state, the money is there for that purpose. And I suppose that should be comforting. But they probably will want to maintain the money in there because they will, I think, be able to look at just the revenues coming in and see enough revenue there to do many of the things they're hoping to do going into the session.
I'm putting you on the spot here, but do you happen to know the last time we took a significant percentage out of the Rainy Day Fund?
Well, we did it last session. We took some money out for water spending, which is the type of project that it's meant for, mm-hmm. you know, infrastructure projects, sort of one-time capital investments. And then more recently, I think you could look at the Proposition 1 statewide ballot initiative that just passed in November that voters approved. That doesn't take money out of Rainy Day Fund, but it sort of redirects part of the stream that would have flowed into the Rainy Day Fund into road funding.
We love redirecting things in this state.
It's funny. I mean, it's either a really cynical move or a really sort of elegant move, depending on your perspective. I mean, it was because of the sense that you can't withdraw from the Rainy Day Fund. There's a big political barrier to doing that. I think the idea was, why don't we just take this money into road funding, which we all know we need to find funding for before it even gets to the Rainy Day Fund when it becomes, you know, emergency rainy day money.
So remarkably, candidates on both sides of the aisle have agreed recently on the need to eliminate diversions from the state highway fund, which, if I understand correctly, a lot of that money has been going to fund DPS.
Yes.
Does that mean, first of all, that a diversion elimination bill should pass easily in this session?
Well, I think it's, yes, I can see that happening because I think, as you say, it's a bipartisan priority. There's a sense on both sides that that there's a bit of sort of budget chicanery going on. Not maybe so consciously, but that there's streams of money that are not going to their intended purpose, that there's pockets of money that kind of become forgotten about, that there's a lack of clarity and transparency about what we're actually deciding to tax and spend on. So I can see, and that's been certainly one of the popular approaches to finding more funding for roads, which I think anyone who's driven on a road in Texas lately would agree is probably a good priority. I don't know if that'll be the only thing they do on road funding, but I think that seems like a natural first step.
What happens to DPS if those diversions are stopped?
Well, that's an interesting question because, of course, in addition to the fact that they wouldn't get those diversions, they will potentially have expanded funding needs because of the deal that was made last year to expand the DPS presence on the border. As it stands now, that deal is set through March. I believe it was Joe Strauss who asked for the deal to sort of be revisited in March because he felt that the ledge coming back in should have a chance to decide for itself whether to continue that expansion of DPS presence. Then Senator Patrick, now Lieutenant Governor-elect Dan Patrick, has said that he wants that expansion to be more long-term, even permanent. So that would mean an expanded funding need for DPS. So potentially, depending on the revenue estimate, there could be enough money in GR that it could be allocated to DPS for that. But that'll depend on what the revenue estimate, I guess, actually is.
GR, general revenue?
Yes.
Okay. How secure is Joe Strauss's position as Speaker of the House?
Oh my God, it's so secure. It was really never not secure, I think. But, mm-hmm. You know, since in 2009, he was elected Speaker of the House with a bipartisan coalition that was mostly Democrats, 65-11, I think. You only need a majority to become Speaker of the House. And then since then, he's been reelected without, you know, formal opposition. This time around, he has a formal opposition in Scott Turner, who's a sophomore representative from Frisco. And Turner's argument is that Strauss is a rhino, is a moderate, and he's the real conservative. And he started out about a year ago saying he wants a record vote on this. And now it's Strauss saying he wants a record vote on this. And Strauss's people saying they want the record vote because the record vote will show perhaps at most 20 people voting for Scott Turner, everyone else voting for Strauss. And 20 is probably an exaggeration. So Strauss will start the session being, you know, reelected deliberately, numerically, overwhelmingly, I think, which puts him in a pretty good spot.
What is it? I don't know that much about Turner, but is it unwise of him to mount a challenge to somebody as powerful as Joe Strauss when he is a sophomore representative?
Well, I would say not unwise. I mean, it's a free country. I mean, this is politics. There's a certain value, I think, even to Scott Turner and to Scott Turner's supporters in saying, in expressing their views and expressing what they would like to see in a speaker. I wouldn't fault anybody for running for an office, really ever, I think. But I think for Turner, the goal, I think, is in part to maybe burnish his credentials as a conservative statewide, perhaps eventually run for higher office for the U.S. House, for example, just because as a matter of arithmetic, there was never really a path for the Tea Party candidate to become Speaker of the House because the Democrats, who are the minority, obviously, but still a pretty sizable minority, would naturally vote for the centrist Republican over the Tea Party alternative.
So I feel like every time I've had you on the show, I've said this sentence, but Republicans have held every statewide office in Texas since 1994 and have had strong majorities in the State House and Senate. It does seem this term that there is very little centrist GOP presence remaining. Will you talk a little bit about that shift?
Sure. So yeah, it's funny. I mean, we've always had the sentence about it's been 20 years. And I don't know about you, but I don't think anyone was expecting how thoroughly they were going to win in 2014. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see the margins just balloon from 13 points statewide between Rick Perry and Bill White to 20 points between Greg Abbott and Wendy Davis. You see in exit polls this sort of surprising Republican hegemony among lots of different subsets of the electorate. You see, you know, Republicans winning in urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas. I mean, it's just so thorough. And as you said, it's what's changed in the ledge is not so much a change in the Republican-Democrat split. It's only a couple seats that have changed hands. But there's about 30 new freshmen between the House and the Senate, most of whom are more conservative or farther to the right than the people they replaced. So either an incumbent retired, somebody more conservative came in, or an incumbent was challenged in the primary, the challenger won. At the same time, although that sort of infusion of new conservative blood would push the ledge farther right, it seems to me that it was such a Republican victory in 2014. It wasn't a Tea Party wave. It was a Republican wave, right? So if you have Joe Strauss, who I guess is the sort of most visible moderate Republican in the state as Speaker of the House, you have Greg Abbott talking about wanting to prioritize education. And even Dan Patrick, I think, talking about issues like property taxes, which are not really fringe issues. I'm not sure that the ledge will be as far right as some of the new candidates would suggest.
My guest is Texas Monthly reporter Erica Greeter. We're getting a preview of the 84th session of the Texas Legislature. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Texas Monthly's Erica Greeter to get a preview of the 84th session of the Texas Legislature. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Erica, an unusual number of newcomers this year in the House and the Senate, considering that the parties didn't turn over. How long does it typically take freshman lawmakers to sort of get their feet under them?
Oh, wow. Some, I think, come out right out of the gate with a lot of ideas and initiative and mischief, which is fun to see. Some take probably decades, I guess. we'll see of the new crop. I mean, it's funny because some of the Tea Party people who were elected in that little boomlet of 2012 are now sort of coming back as sophomores and have more aspirations on policy and so on. So I'll be excited to watch what they do, how they proceed.
I don't want to get too far diverted from this, but what's your process for getting to know these individuals? And is it a lot of phone calls? Do you sort of ask to meet them in their offices? How do you get to know the newcomers?
Well, I try to meet them in their offices or just downtown in Austin when they're in town, since a lot of them are still moving into their offices or haven't actually been sworn in yet. I just kind of reach out. I mean, it's you can sort of, I think it's, I'm not sure if I'll talk to everyone in the House this session. I'll probably talk to everyone in the Senate and most of the people in the House. You can also, of course, walk around on the floor and talk to them at the railing or see them in passing. And, you know, in Austin, there's like only two coffee shops near the Capitol. So you just can go sit there and wait for them to come by.
Any notable shifts likely this time around in committee appointments or chairmanships?
Well, I think, yes, there will be. In the Senate, of course, Senator Patrick, now Lieutenant Governor-elect Patrick, one of his sort of campaign points against the incumbent Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst was that Dewhurst had appointed Democrats too often to chair committees. So Patrick has sort of, he has not ruled out appointing Democrats to chair committees, which is fortunate because he really probably should appoint, you know, several. He might only appoint one. But the reason that's important is because there's 31 senators, eight new Republicans, one new Democrat, I guess, in Senator Van de Putte's seat, and that's the special election happening today in San Antonio. There's really not enough, I think, institutional expertise among the Republican caucus because it's so many new faces to fill all the committee assignments. So I think we'll probably see Senator Schwertner, Charles Schwertner, on Health and Human Services. I think he'll be very good. I think he's thoughtful. He's a sophomore senator, but he, you know, was thoughtful last session, was in the House before. We might then see someone like Senator Donna Campbell as chair of public education, which will be interesting.
Governor-elect Abbott has said that education is essentially his top priority. How do you imagine that that might manifest itself in the bills that he wants to throw his weight behind?
Well, I think what we'll see will be a lot of policy discussion on education, structure of education, school choice, curricular standards, administrative standards. You've seen, for example, Joe Strauss came out yesterday talking about wanting more training for high school counselors because we have this newly structured high school curriculum. So expanding on that, he wants more counselors to be able to advise and talk to high school students about how they should approach their education, their potentially post-high school education. I think we'll see a lot of that. We'll see some efforts at school choice and expansion of school choice. I'm not sure we'll see, it'll be incremental. It won't be, you know, I think a radical change. We'll probably see more school choice by the end of session. We'll see some more debates about curriculum, things like Common Core. That'll probably be analogous to the C-scope debate from last session. I don't think we'll see a lot of discussion about the funding side of things because of, you know, as long as the courts have not issued their final ruling on that, I mean, that issue seems to be a bit off limits for the time being.
Common Core seems like an incredible long shot for a state like Texas.
Well, you know, it's funny. I would agree. I'm not sure why it's such an animating issue, although clearly it is. I suppose it seems like federal imposition of bureaucratic standards. I'm not sure if it's really that overwhelmingly rigid, but certainly it's not a popular not a popular thing in Texas.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Alan in Grapevine. Hey, Alan.
Oh, yes. My question has to do with the lottery and its relationship to school funding. The impression that I have is that all the money that goes towards the purchase of lottery tickets, billions and billions of dollars have gone towards education. Is the lottery monies, is that part of the general fund, or is that dedicated money strictly for education?
Thanks for your call. Has the education thing ever been a fact, Erica Greeter?
Alan, that's a great question. I'm actually not sure. I don't know. That has been the purpose of it. I'm not sure if... I actually just can't tell you. I'm trying to picture the BRE, and I can't picture if that's a separate stream.
Okay. Well, maybe we can get an answer in a future program. Thanks for your call, Alan.
Sorry, Alan.
Let's talk about this. The Texas Dream Act passed nearly unanimously in 2001. This is the measure that lets certain qualified undocumented immigrants pay in-state tuition rates at Texas universities.
Yes.
It seems like night and day since that time. Why has support fallen off so dramatically?
Well, as you say, it passed almost unanimously. It was signed by Governor Perry and really didn't elicit much backlash at all until last year. And so I think what happened last year was that in a very conservative state, in a state where the Republican Party is obviously conservative by any normal standard, there were a lot of primary challenges. And if you're trying to win a primary challenge in Texas as a conservative, you really have to sort of scramble to find the issues that mark you out as more conservative than the person you're campaigning against, who's also obviously conservative. So that's why you saw some really sort of small issues get brought up in those primaries. And I think the problem here is that there are certain campaign promises that can be sort of quietly ignored after an election. But in some cases, you have people who made a specific promise: I'm going to repeal the Texas Dream Act. I'm going to stop this program. I'm going to stop this. And so now coming back, they really have to do that because they said they would. And once that kind of bill is filed, then it can proceed. So I think in this case, someone like Senator-elect Lois Kolkhorst, who was in the House at the time the bill passed and voted for it, was sort of criticized for having voted for the bill in the first place, the In-State Tuition Act, and then pledged that she's against it now, and she will carry the bill to repeal it if that's how the bill gets through the Senate. And then it gets into the House, and I think there are probably Republicans who don't really have that much of a problem with it, but they would have a problem being seen voting against the repeal effort.
You had a lengthy sit-down with Lieutenant Governor-elect Dan Patrick for your article in the magazine last month. He certainly had to fight hard to get where he is. What are his priorities with regard to new legislation?
You know, it's interesting. He has a very, very right-wing reputation, partly deserved because, you know, his background is in talk radio, so he's a fiery radio host like you, Chris.
My right-wing reputation precedes me.
I know. It's just it's incredible. He's really talked about, you know, a similar set of issues for most of the time he's been in the Senate. So one thing he's been talking about quite a bit is he wants to see tax relief, property tax relief. He's been talking about that since he was a radio host, and it was a big part of his campaign in 2006 for the state Senate. He seems committed to pursuing that. I'm not sure how it's going to work out. Of course, the property tax is a local issue. It is quite high in Texas. I mean, it varies by where you are, but the median property tax burden is, I think, eighth highest in the country. So it's not unreasonable, but it would create a sort of funding gap if any measure to that effect is passed, because there are things, the property tax funds, and there's no plans to, I think, provide an additional revenue stream or to expand any other revenue streams to offset that. Patrick's idea is that if you constrain the property tax, then that will just naturally encourage more efficient spending on the part of local governments, which I'm not sure is realistic. So we'll see how that plays out. I think beyond that, he wants to see policy reforms on education. He was chair of public ed last time. It's still a priority for him. He wants to see more border security. He's been focused on that for since 2006 also. He probably does not put as much effort into some of the social conservative issues that people would think. Although if those issues are brought up in the Senate, he might then be a supporter.
So in other words, they're not priorities for him, but he's not necessarily going to divert from the party line.
That's my sense of him. Mm-hmm. I remember in 2011, I went and talked to him, and I asked him about his priorities for the session, and he said things, you know, property taxes, school, expanding, you know, educational opportunity, border security. And then I asked him, how about any social issues? And he said, no, I'm done with those. And I was like, you're done with those? I was just so surprised. And he said, yeah, you know, I carried the sonogram law, and I carried the In God We Trust being added to the Senate. And, you know, so he did a couple things, and he felt like he was moving on to other issues. So, but then I can imagine if the issue arises because of a Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage, for example, or if a senator files a bill, he might then pick up the issue.
Is his devotion to further securing our southern border with state resources, is that motivated by an influx of undocumented immigrants, laborers and their families, or is that motivated by concerns about terrorism coming from other parts of the world?
You know, it's for Patrick, it has to be, I think, the former, because he's been talking about it for so long. So more recently in the campaign, for example, he was talking about terrorism. He was saying, you know, he was strongly implying that ISIS fighters could or would be crossing the southern border, would be entering the United States via Mexico, which he and I had a kind of an argument about when I talked to him, because it just seems so implausible and inefficient to me that they would do that. which he was not very amused by. But he's had this concern about unauthorized immigration since 2006, so before the formation of ISIS. It's often been framed from a public safety point of view, I think, for him. He points out how many crimes in Texas have been committed by unauthorized immigrants and so on. So I think that's where that originates.
Is that a valid concern? I mean, I don't know if you know the percentages, but are there a lot of crimes in Texas committed by immigrants without legal authorization to live in the U.S.?
There are crimes committed by unauthorized immigrants, of course. On a per capita basis, the crime rate is probably somewhat lower for unauthorized immigrants than for native-born Texans. I usually think of a distinction between unauthorized immigrants who are here to work, economic migrants, which has been the case for a long time in Texas. That's what most of the immigrants are here for. But of course, there is a criminal element in any subset of people, right? And then beyond the sort of, I don't know what the word for it, beyond the regular criminal element, there's a subset of unauthorized border activity that's specifically unauthorized border activity. So trafficking, human trafficking, arms trafficking, drug trafficking. I think that conflating those groups makes it harder to focus on the trafficking aspect and the criminal aspect. And when I put it that way to Patrick, he said that he, you know, agreed, and that it's partly because of he seemed to kind of understand that distinction. But nonetheless, I think looks at the public safety aspect as the first priority. So would like to allocate more.
What are the limits of the state's authority to secure the borders? I mean, are there jurisdictional issues that, you know, the DPS faces when they come up against ICE authorities?
Well, there are. That was, I think, part of the issue this summer with some of the children, the unauthorized children traveling on their own. They have to be treated differently as minors under federal law than an unauthorized adult who can be sort of released on their own recognizance. Obviously, you can't let a kid, you know, just wander off by themselves. But I'm not sure the jurisdictional issues will become a huge constraint. If those questions are raised for Texas, then it might be sort of a debate between DOJ and the state. But that probably isn't the major issue right now. I think one thing that was interesting about last year's debate on this was that when Perry and Strauss and Dewhurst announced they were extending the expanded operational presence on the border, both Perry and Dewhurst said, you know, by doing this, we've secured the border, right? So there's been this kind of ongoing debate about what would it actually mean for the border to be secure? What is appropriately secure? Does it mean, I mean, obviously there's a lot of legal traffic across the border too. It's an international border. There's a lot of lawful commerce and trade and recreational activity and social activity. And we don't want to end that. We don't want to, you know, shut down the border entirely. But there seemed to be a sense among the statewide leaders that by virtue of what they had done last year, they had achieved the appropriate amount of border security. And I think Patrick agreed with that because he said that he wanted to continue that indefinitely. So maybe at least now we have a standard for what it means to have a secure border.
I was surprised to discover that if open carry of handguns passes in Texas in this upcoming session, we'll actually be among the last states to enact this.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
I would not have imagined that would be true.
I was surprised, too. I mean, it sounds so strange, but really there's like 45 states that already have open carry, and we're just not one of them. I think it's kind of the low-hanging fruit. And frankly, I would look at that and say, you know, if you pass open carry, that's a big guns bill. It probably, if you're a gun control person, it probably offsets the need for other guns bills or the demand for other guns bills. So I think that typically what states have done is passed open carry laws with municipal sort of carve-out provisions. So if you're in Dallas and Dallas doesn't want open carry in the streets of Dallas, Dallas can, you know, decide not in Dallas city limits, and so can Austin and so on. And I think that's typically the case. And I don't think in practice it hasn't been a major issue in the states where it's been legalized.
My guest is journalist Erica Greeter of Texas Monthly. We're getting a preview of the 84th session of the Texas Legislature. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Texas Monthly journalist Erica Greeter. We're getting a preview of the 84th session of the Texas Legislature, which kicks into action next Tuesday at noon. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Erica, you've suggested that Democrats might attach a rider to a bill calling for open carry that would provide for additional mental health services. Is that something the bill supporters, you think, are willing to countenance?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that we saw last session Republicans were willing to expand funding to mental health services. We had previously been ranked dead last among all states as far as mental health funding, and I think that was, it was a stated priority to tackle that at the beginning of session. And then after the Sandy Hook tragedy, I think that only underlined the need for more resources for that area of state services. So that's just sort of, you know, an example of the kind of thing I think that Democrats could be doing. On a lot of issues, there's just such a big Republican majority that Democrats are going to have trouble stopping stuff. But I think they still have room to think about improving things or making things more well thought out through the legislative process of discussion and negotiation.
Is there anything, are there any Democrat-driven bills that are likely to at least receive serious debate and consideration in this session?
I'm sure there will be. I think that what's interesting, too, is a couple issues that are coming up that are not really partisan issues. I guess in retrospect, looking back at 2013, it was a pretty good session, but because of the 2014 elections pending, there was a sort of political dynamic for a lot of key players who were looking at higher office or looking at running again in 2014, or who were at least thinking about campaigns. And this time around, that sort of mooted. So, for example, you know, with Abbott saying that he was interested in hearing about how Utah expanded Medicaid under sort of Utah-specific terms, that got like national headlines a few weeks ago, even though all he'd said was he wanted to hear about it. Perhaps because Perry had been so far in the other camp of, I don't even want to hear about it, we're not going to do it, we're not going to consider it, forget it. So on issues like Medicaid expansion, with Abbott talking about it, with the Senate Health Committee talking about it, I'm seeing a possibility for more bipartisan discussion than the raw numbers.
I gather we could look at other states, other Republican states that have sort of found ways to make Medicaid expansion palatable.
Sure, yeah. I mean, and I think that it's not, there's nothing wrong with having that discussion, right? I mean, having a discussion doesn't entail anything of anybody. But last session, it seemed like even having the discussion or even raising the possibility was for Republicans in the caucus, you know, some sort of doctrinal lapse that would come back to haunt them.
So I was looking around for interesting things to discuss, and I came upon a note that Lyle Larson, a Republican in San Antonio, would like to authorize counties to house prison inmates in tents. And I'm curious, I don't know if you're familiar with the bill, but is that sort of thing a stunt, or are there counties that in fact want or need to make such a move?
I suppose he must have a reason for that, right? That's so random that, I mean,
I know they do it in Arizona, or they have, but
as opposed to holding them in prisons, or as opposed to not having prisoners at all?
I suppose, to be honest, I don't have the full text of what's been proposed. That was sort of the bullet version of it. But I guess it's not generating a great deal of talk if it's not something that you've heard a lot about.
It's sort of a perplexing one. I mean, I'll look at it. It sounds like there must be something to the story. But, you know, since the state's incarceration rate is declining, we were a couple of years ago, we had the second highest incarceration rate, and now we're only fourth highest. And there's been some prisons closed, so I don't think we have a problem with needing more capacity in prisons right now. We're probably a bit overbuilt on prisons. Maybe it's a local issue where there's a specific need for more capacity in his district, and they want sort of pop-up facilities to that end. But yeah, I'm not sure.
Are we trimming inmate populations because of, like, jail diversion programs for drug offenders?
Yeah, and so that's been one of, I think, the real success stories in the state in the past few sessions, and I think we could see more reforms along these lines, too. There's been a fair amount of criminal justice reform, you know, pursued by a really a left-right coalition. The left, for the traditional left reasons about, you know, over-incarceration rates and the effects that has on communities, but from the right, too, concerns about the cost of over-incarceration, the cost of encouraging recidivism effectively, the cost of keeping people out of the workforce and kind of separating them from the normal course of life for nonviolent crimes, for small offenses. So I think we'll continue to see that. It's an issue that really Democrats, Republicans, and the Tea Party types, I think, have some interest in.
What sort of discussion is there about making pre-kindergarten universally available to public school students in Texas?
That also seems to get some bipartisan traction. The way Abbott's framed it, and he framed it this way during the campaign, was that he would like to do a pilot program for it and see how it goes. I think that makes sense. I mean, we arguably have a sort of citywide pilot program in San Antonio, which expanded pre-K a couple years ago by raising the sales tax. And so we can start tracking the results of that. We also have a lot of national data. Generally, pre-K is considered one of the best interventions you can make, one of the best investments in a child's educational future. But to do it statewide in one session would be a big project. So I can imagine it happening in a more incremental fashion. Let's, you know, do the pilot this session and then come back and expand it after that.
And are most of these provisions, they make it universally available but not compulsory in the way that I think kindergarten is now compulsory in Texas, right?
Yeah, I guess it is compulsory. I mean, that's how it would be structured. I think there would be a pretty high pickup rate if it's universally available and if it's at the same place as the neighborhood school. But I think there wouldn't be much push for it to be compulsory, or if any. I think that would – there would be really no need.
And I see that Tom Craddock filed a bill to ban texting while driving. That seems like something that would – I don't know that there's universal support, but it doesn't sound particularly controversial.
Austin has that ban now. It's kind of – obviously, we shouldn't text while we drive. I mean, I do it. I don't know if that's a bad confession to make, but I sometimes do it. It's horrible. It's like we all know how horrible it is. It's just such a huge distraction from – driving, which is already a cognitively complex task. So in that sense, I mean, yeah, we probably shouldn't text while driving, but this kind of thing, like bans on sort of small behaviors, people just hate that kind of thing. It's like the soda tax. People just really don't like it. It feels like, you know, Big Brother.
So there's that nanny state resistance to things like that.
Yeah, it just, mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to inspire just disproportionate outrage from everybody. Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me not to text while driving.
It seems like now that I suppose we're past the questions about voter ID, the voting legislation that's been proposed has been mostly proposed by Democrats who appear to want to expand registration and ability to vote.
Right. And I think we'll still see some more activity on voting laws in Texas from the courts. I think because they're in the courts, it's one of several issues. Gay marriage, I guess, abortion, to school funding, that are still in the courts, so the ledge probably won't act on its own. But for the Democrats, they'd like to make it easier to train to register voters. The state currently requires that you train by county, that you register voters in your county, and so on. But it's not necessarily contentious, I don't think. So in Tarrant County, they do online voter registrar training. Tarrant County is like the hotbed of Tea Party activity in Texas. So if Tarrant County is making it easier to train as a registrar online, I'm not sure why other counties would object to doing the same.
Can you envision a scenario in which same-sex marriage would come up for consideration before the Texas legislature?
Well, I can, yes, sort of. I can envision a lot of scenarios because there's several kind of concurrent court cases in the Fifth Circuit with the Supreme Court. Where rulings could be handed down. I think there's one ruling from the Fifth Circuit coming down this week, isn't there? So if there's a ruling that affects Texas this spring, and there well could be, then that would certainly inspire a lot of discussion about it at the ledge. But I'm not sure if that would actually inspire any legislation to be filed, because there's already a statutory and constitutional provision against gay marriage in Texas. They don't really need to add more of those. That wouldn't change anything. The legislature can't move to overrule the Supreme Court. So, and then beyond that, frankly, I would guess the majority of legislators realize the state will have gay marriage pretty soon and are okay with that and are not that animated about the issue. So,
and of
I
course,
think it would be...
If the Tea Party has a lot of control of the far right wing of the party in Texas, they are not necessarily individuals who are motivated by religious right values. They've tried to define themselves to the extent that they do define themselves by fiscal conservatism, right?
Right, and you're right. There's an interesting split in the Tea Party. I mean, the Tea Party is sort of the umbrella term for the farther right subset of the caucus, but within the Tea Party, there's a split between this sort of libertarian-type Tea Partiers and the religious right-type Tea Partiers. And, you know, demographically, the voters who support the Tea Party tend to be religious right. They're older, more evangelical, more affluent, more interested in social issues. But among the Tea Party set of legislators, a fair number of them came from, you know, Ron Paul rallies. So they would not be, first and foremost, religious right affiliates.
So tell us what you can about, say, the working relationship you might be able to predict between Lieutenant Governor Patrick and Governor Abbott.
So I think they will try to work together. I think that both Abbott and Patrick have a motivation to be good at their jobs. I think, you know, Abbott, there's Abbott is under the shadow of Rick Perry, who's been governor for such a long time. Abbott wants to carve out his own legacy as governor. He wants to be serious about substantive issues like education. Patrick, too, I think after years in the Senate, kind of as this firebrand, wants to be a respected and esteemed lieutenant governor. And he wants, you know, to have big reforms, and he wants to pass serious legislation. If there's any friction between the two of them, or if relations sort of fall into disarray, Abbott can always work with Strauss. And if there's, you know, if you have these three sort of actors, the House, the Senate, and the governor, two of the three can control the order of events. So if Abbott and Patrick have difficulties, I think that we'll see Abbott and Strauss working together to effectively overrule the Senate.
What is Governor Perry doing in his last week?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean,
is it ceremonial at this point, most of what he's engaged in?
It's mostly ceremonial. I guess he's been doing mostly ceremonial stuff for a while, and a lot of travel and a lot of kind of campaign stuff. I mean, clearly he's planning on running in 2016, or, you know, at least making preparations to do so, and taking a lot of meetings, doing a lot of policy studying, doing some international travel. He'll probably be sticking around Austin and kind of doing state business, winding down. I mean, it's been such a long time that he's had that office. It'll never happen again. Yeah, I think we'll see him stay close to Texas and give a big farewell State of the State speech next week.
Talk a little bit about the energy in Austin when the legislature is in session. Does it feel different than it does the rest of the time?
It feels different for those of us who are in the Capitol bubble, I think. It feels like, you know, like summer camp for 4 months. Because it's just, it's that hive of activity at the Capitol. People are just there for hours and hours and hours a day. It's only 4 months. They have to get things done by the end, although they might come back for specials. So they're there. I mean, you're just there. You're stuck there. You're in that building. You're around that building in those blocks for 12, 16, 18 hours a day during session. Sort of Camp Capitol.
So is that the refrain? It's only 4 months. It's only 4 months.
No, because I think in this era, in our era of special sessions, you can't really assume it's only going to be 4 months. Mm. But it certainly is it's a marathon and a sprint, I would say.
Journalist Erica Greeter writes for Texas Monthly Magazine, where last month she published a profile of Lieutenant Governor-elect Dan Patrick. The 84th session of the Texas legislature begins next Tuesday, January 13th. Erica, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Likewise. Thanks, Chris.
Have fun at camp.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.